Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Kosai. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Kosai starting on May 10th. So get your tickets now at kosai.org.
There's a whole fleet of them. Look on the ASA. My gosh. They're all going against the wind.
It was basically a cube with inside of sphere where the points of the cube were touching outside of the sphere.
So this isn't anything that just is limited to the United States. It's a worldwide phenomenon.
That UFO podcast is powered by Zencastr. Zencastr is one of the world's leading platforms for recording and hosting podcasts. Zencastr is a modern web-based solution for high-quality audio and video podcast production. With a full suite of professional tools, Zencastr allows podcasters to quickly and seamlessly record their guests remotely and produce their podcasts in studio quality. Check out the links in the show description to find out more.
This is David Marler, UFO researcher, and you're listening to That UFO Podcast.
Hi, everyone, and welcome back to That UFO Podcast. As always, my name is Andy, and special treat for you today. I've got Dan jumping on this one with me. Dan, how are you doing?
I'm great, thank you. It's nice to be here, and especially to meet today's guest.
Yeah, you only jump on with the big ones, don't you? That's everyone knows, so that's it. But yes, we have YouTuber, author, retired F-16 pilot, father, among many other things. I have Chris Leto on the pod with us today. Chris, how are we?
Yeah, excellent. Great to be here.
Is it Leto or Leto?
I don't really know how to say it perfectly. I think it's Leto is the Finnish pronunciation, but I guess Leto.
Either or works, yeah, and that's fine, yeah. I mean, that's like me. I still don't know. My surname's McGrillin, which even me saying that on the podcast, most listeners still won't have understood what I've just said. But I don't know if it's M small c capital G or M then all the small letters. So if anyone out there knows, people will get in touch with me. That would be great. If you could tell me how to spell my surname after 35 years, it'd be fantastic. But listen, Chris, you are someone who, it just seems, especially in the last kind of 6 months or so, has become really prominent in the UFO, UAP community for all sorts of reasons. You are going to be on Ryan Sprague's podcast in the coming days or week, or if you're listening to this in the future, it's been, go and check that one out. We're friends with Ryan Sprague, Somewhere in the Skies. And yeah, Ryan's introduced you as being on his podcast as almost a rebuttal to his previous guest that was Mick West. We are not going to try and make this a conversation all about Mick and his crazy theories and stuff. We're going to focus on you and people finding out about yourself, Chris. Always like to start off by asking a little bit about your early life and your background and kind of what got you to the point of joining the military and getting to what you do now.
Sorry, I have Discord. I'll break right here. Let me turn off my Discord. Sorry, man.
No, you're okay. Don't worry.
Could you hear it? Like the beeping? I heard it. Okay. I'll just answer it.
Or listen, Chris, we could leave this bit in and we could say, is that Discord part of your Patreon service that people can access? Yeah.
Yeah, the Discord, well, it is, right? I meant to give some better benefit to Patreons, but I think I'll just talk to the Patreons. You know, I'm still trying to figure out how best to reward Patreons or make it worth their while. And then, because I'm gaining a huge amount of value just in feedback, support, you know, just even the financial support helps just cover all the monthly costs, you know, that you end up incurring. So I don't know. We might just open it up. I like Discord because I think it's usable. You know, you can use it for teams, especially working online. It's just so usable.
Yeah, it's a good platform. Anyway. We've got it for the podcast as well. So we'll leave that bit in and we'll put Chris's links for his Patreon and stuff within the show description, folks, too. And you're going to find out a lot about Chris in the next hour and a half, however long it may be. So yeah, Chris, early life, tell us a little bit about yourself.
Yeah, so I grew up in Houston. My parents actually, they in the Vietnam War, so they were against the war in Vietnam, actually. Conscientious objector was my dad, and though he was in university, grew up in the Northeast, and they moved out to New Mexico and like lived out, you know, in like a commune or something. I'm not sure. But basically, they lived out in New Mexico, and that's where I was born, like in an adobe house. And then at 2 years old, I think they were like, all right, we need to do like a real regular life or something, provide for our kids. And so they moved to Houston. That was like the boom town. Houston was exploding. They had all these new Astrodome. They had all these giant facilities, sports teams. It was when NASA was big. So they moved there, and my mom worked for IBM, ended up having a long career with IBM. My dad set up computers, like small computer systems, essentially, but then Windows came and basically, you know, kind of took over the market. So I grew up just in suburbia of Houston, you know, played soccer, tennis, and running. And then it was all about grades in my family. You know, basically I got all A's, so you're going to get all A's, you know. But with that being said, if I did get all A's and played the sports, you know, I had, you know, free rein, or not free rein, but at least I could, I had a very, I would almost call it, you know, privileged, if you will, life, which is hard to fathom when you get to a point and you have, you know, everything's still difficult, but everything's provided, but you're still not really happy. You know, you're not happy with the future that is laid out. And not that my parents were, you know, liberal household. Free thinking was, you know, a must. Exactly. Using your brain. And so it's basically, I got to that point where I just want a different path in my life, get some discipline in my life. And then this guy in my physics class, he basically talked about the Air Force Academy, explained it to me throughout the year. And finally I just applied and then went, actually, they let me in, went through the Air Force Academy. It was amazing, actually, amazing experience. You know, anybody that, it's just so difficult, anybody that goes and can make it through, it's just mentally stronger. So really anyone that you have to be crazy enough just to choose to make it through, you know, but once they do that, or for whatever reasons are motivated, you do end up a different, person at the end. I think in a lot of ways better, you know, but didn't have a normal college experience. You know, you're basically, I met a lot of my friends on the tour pad. It's basically when you get in trouble, if you're 10 minutes late or something for a class, you have to spend that the next weekend essentially marching back and forth with a plastic rifle, 11 hours actually. So there's some just crazy punishments, etc. But met some amazing people there. That the NFT guy I was talking with you about, he actually, my buddy Jimmy, he actually was from the Air Force Academy, met him there. So just met amazing people. And then by the end, one of the benefits of going to the Air Force Academy is you have almost a free ticket into pilot training. Not a free ticket, but they do use those slots first, really, because it's the most expensive, you know, for the government. So if you want to be a pilot, and you graduate from the Air Force Academy, you don't have a guaranteed slot, but you have a very high chance. So from there, I went to pilot training. And I grew up actually just playing video games all the time, which helped a lot. I was like a side video game addict. You know, I know all the, like Doom with my buddy on the internet. Somehow he was able to set up Doom. Jay Abney, actually, he made a company, he makes a game, Gods of Olympus, amazing game now. But back in the day, we were playing Doom, just linked up over, you know, the internet before there was an internet, you know, essentially. So playing video games helped me through pilot training. Was able to succeed at pilot training and got a F-16 slot.
Which is pretty cool to be flying any kind of plane, aircraft, let alone an F-16. in between that as well, now, did you have any interest in UFOs or UAPs, aliens like that growing up? Or was that something that's kind of came later in life?
I mean, literally zero, you know, I mean, zero. I looked into nothing. I considered it all, you know, essentially just fake or, you know, disingenuous.
Yeah.
You know, because I went into the Air Force Academy, I really liked chemistry. I grew up at my high school. I really liked chemistry. I remember as a young kid being told by many of the people around me, you know, it's kind of a religious Methodist area I grew up in. Just as a kid, you know, you're like laying in bed at your first sleepover, you know, and the guy's like, you know, you don't believe in God? And I'm like, no. And he's like, well, you're going to go to hell, you know? And I just remember that from a very early age. And it keeps getting reminded of that, like constantly, you know, everybody, God bless you. I mean, everything, you know, if you're not religious, it's difficult to understand growing up in a religious society, you know. And I really feel like, you know, I say I was oppressed, and people maybe laugh about that, you know, but I think it is. I think it's definitely oppression of thought. And so at any rate, I always felt a need to find out the truth. You know, I was like, you know, am I really surrounded by all these people who can say they see these things that are invisible? You know, I realistically thought they were just all crazy, like literally insane. But if you think everyone else is insane, then chances are it's you that actually is insane. You know, like if there's not an asshole in the room, chances are it's you, you know? So, I was just very interested in finding the truth. And so that's what drew me to chemistry and physics would have also been, I think if I had to do it over again, I probably would have picked something more leaning towards physics, because I actually was a material scientist, which was a degree which is combines chemistry and physics kind of together. You know, that's where your materials kind of meet, I guess. And so that's what really drew me to that. If I had to do it again, I may lean more towards the physics, you know, knowing what I know now. But chemistry is also very, very handy. And I took a lot of biology classes, you know, biochemistry. You know, all those classes are just mind-blowing. You know, like I love the YouTubers that blew my mind. You know, I just look up to those guys so much, like Vsauce. But any of these advanced classes, you know, if you really go into biochemistry and if, you know, if you take a college level class, like a serious class on biochemistry, what I took away from that is it's like unbelievably complicated. And we really don't know what's going on. You know, we have these, we say there's like the Krebs process and we say all these things, but you know, I've seen how they got the information. And it's a lot of it's just kind of a guess, right? And just trying to fill, you know, you're looking at just, it's what I've argued in my last video, you know, I think we're physically looking into other dimensions. So it's not so easy.
Yeah, and we're definitely going to get to that last video in a little bit. Yeah. And it's funny you mention about like physics class. I mentioned online recently, but I, growing up, always had the intention of taking physics, having an interest in space and all that kind of stuff. I wouldn't have been particularly good. I wasn't gifted mathematically, and I think you kind of have to be, especially from a physics point of view. I ended up just taking chemistry because it sounded more fun than biology. But the reason I didn't take physics was I got to what you would call high school. It's secondary school in the UK or Scotland. And we got like a tester class where you go in for an hour and the teacher essentially gets to pitch the class to you. And I remember he was a Star Trek geek and he was telling us all this stuff and it sounded great. And he turned around to the class and this one moment changed the course of my education, where he said, you know, it's children like you who will grow up to be the scientists of the future, who are going to redirect asteroids and comets heading towards the Earth. And he mentioned this one. And I just remember thinking, that sounds like a lot of responsibility that necessarily want.
I went the other way.
And do you know what? That's where I was going. I was like, yeah, that's not for me. Someone else can deal with that. I am not dealing with some Bruce Willis Armageddon level stuff here. So I think I made the right choice and now a podcast. And
but you've never been presented with the question fully, you know? I disagree, actually, Andy. I think that, you know, the only reason, like, smarter people are smarter is they just think about it more and more and more, you know, it's like any muscle. You know, I think most people just think about their sports team, you know, or trading money, or, you know, they're just not they're not just practicing, focusing on processing, because it's difficult, right? I remember my first physics class, man, it's extremely hard. And we had this lady, you know, let's call her Mrs. Smith, you know, big lady, thick glasses. And she would sit up there on this, you know, projector, you know, where they had the grease projectors. Did you have those?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But she was so cool. And she would just like blow your mind with these physics, you know, these physics proofs, you know, very simple, but very complicated, actually, you know, force equals MA. I mean, those things are not, it's not so intuitive when you really get into the vector math and all that stuff. But I think it's kind of a disservice when people say I don't have the aptitude, you know, or don't think they have the aptitude. And I would say, well, have you tried, you know?
You can see a lot of you can see a lot of your education that's reflected in obviously what you went on to do as a pilot, and not just anyone can become a pilot. And we've heard a lot recently about trained observers and how highly skilled pilots are, which seems a bit obvious, but it's true. You are highly skilled. It's not just a case of here's a test, you pass it, you get to be a pilot. There's a lot of people go for these, and it narrows down to a very small field, and these people get to go and fly very expensive aircraft. As an F-16 pilot, though, what sort of things were you doing? Because were you in foreign countries? Was it missions? As a layman, I would like to know what it was you'd done on an F-16.
Yeah, you know, how do you know a fighter pilot's at the party? You know, he'll tell you. So, I would say that I had an amazing career, really did. You know, one of the reasons is I wanted to, like I said, a different life, a challenging life. And one that you get to travel around. I really like traveling. I love seeing different points of view, different cultures. So I really had a varied career where I was really outside of the U.S. most of the time, to be honest. You know, I was trained in Phoenix, and that's where I met my wife. And then I moved to South Korea. That was my first assignment for a year. And then I met her in Italy. So got to fly in Italy. And those are really just that first year in South Korea, and then the next 3 years in Italy. Those are really my only like operational fighting tours, you know, where you actually would go out. From there, I actually went deployed from Italy to Iraq in 2005 and did like a 5-month tour there. And so that's my only one and only really combat deployment. You know, after that, I went to Alaska, and then from then on, it was basically training. You know, I just didn't agree with all the with the way the wars were going. I didn't believe that going there and shooting people or blowing them up would really fix anything or solve any issues. When I was there, there's a motivation. You really want to help. You know, you really want to win. You don't want all of this to have been for nothing. And you go there and you try really hard, but at the end of the day, you know, what are we really doing? We're just blowing stuff up. You know, if you're going to raid people's houses with helicopters and punch through the front door, you know, are you really going to build a democracy in a foreign country? So I don't know. I just thought, it wasn't really what I was interested in. You know, I thought it'd be more advanced, you know, like protecting, Europe. I liked the NATO. I love NATO. You know, I believe that like keeping Russia, okay, at bay, all right, this dictatorship right on the east, which took over Crimea, essentially. I think that is where we should be focusing our energy. I also don't even agree that we should be picking this fight with China. You know, I think ideologically it's not necessary. I don't know if it's even required, but I see this put, you know, this getting pushed from in the militaries, you know. And I don't know where it's coming from, but we don't have to fight with China. You know, they're like our biggest trading partner. So why would we pick this giant war with our biggest trading partner? You know, it just doesn't make any sense. So I don't think it's necessary. And I don't think they necessarily have the same imperialistic views historically. You know, China's been around for like 7,000 years or how many thousand years. They built a giant wall, you know, to keep everybody out. I don't know if it's necessarily like, you know, the red wall is just going to come and clean everybody over, you know, but whatever.
I digress into
controversial world politics, but I really liked training. I thought it was awesome. I loved working with the people. I loved preparing them to be more survivable and more capable in combat, you know, to preparing our guys, essentially. And then finally, I was just lucky. They kept offering me amazing assignments, and I got to go to Turkey. So I went and learned Turkish for a year in Defense Language Institute. It's in Monterey. That was after Alaska. And that was just unbelievable. Amazing teachers, you know, they just, every day it was like 8 to 10 hours of Turkish. And they just, you learn it, you learn the culture. And then I went to Turkey and flew in this, in one of the squadrons for 2.5 years. So I was just an instructor. They called me Hojam, you know, which means like, Hoja is like a guide or instructor in Turkish. And you know, I played a lot of golf on this really terrible golf course, and I still hate golf and I'm terrible at it. But that was an amazing experience. It's unfortunate because that squadron I was in actually was like the center of the air part of the coup. And so I knew at least 5 of the guys and went to jail. You know, they all had like 2-year-old girls. They all had daughters. That's a fighter pilot thing also. Yeah, great dudes, but they disappeared. Yeah, after that. So that was a crazy assignment. Amazing. And then after Turkey, I went back to Phoenix. And there I had my back crushed. Basically, I herniated disc in my lower back that finally came to root. I think all fighter pilots, at least that I know of, with rare exceptions, have either neck or back issues just from all the Gs. So like our seat is canted back. You know, the Viper is canted back like 30 degrees. Because they couldn't fit it in, right? That's why they canted it back.
Right, okay.
Yeah, so I think we have mostly back issues, but the F-15 guys, you know, their seat's just straight up and down, and they mostly have neck issues, you know? But usually it's kind of a combination. So in Phoenix, I was kind of down. That's where we do the initial basic training. But there, it was really exciting. I got into simulators. So I was lucky enough to run the simulator contract for 2 years. And so basically, I was able to get into the software, how we make simulators, how you come up with line items, you know, how you're going to slowly improve them, and then you do all the maintenance. And we came up with some pretty cool programs to train people. I think novel. That was great. The proudest I was, probably the coolest thing I did, or single thing, was at that base. The F-35s, you know, that's a training base, as well as the F-16s. But the F-35s, you need someone to train against, right? You need someone in the air, ideally, to practice, to be that red. We call it the red air, right? You got blue air as our team, and then you need someone in the air on the other team to practice that red air. And so I really loved that mission. That's where I analyzed all the bad guys, what their systems could do. I went into the NSA NASIC, not the NSA, went to CIA. I got to go to all these cool places. And you really get into the mind of what is the enemy? What can they do? What are they capable of? And how do their systems work? And then you pretend to be those guys as the Red Air, right? To train our guys. You're like the practice squad. But the better the practice squad is, the better the team is, right? So that's why I really enjoyed that that as well. But at Luke, what we're able to do is the problem was they were running out of planes to fight against. So they were stealing F-16 lines. So they're cannibalizing from the F-16 training, which was really hurting because everybody's hurting. No one has fighter pilots around the world. They all, at least in the West, they've all basically run. But what we were able to do is use the Link 16, that data link network, and pretend to make it look like a real aircraft. So basically populate a track on the link and fly it around. So actually train the F-35 guys. I mean, it doesn't work. It helps in like one little sliver, but I was very happy with it because it was free and we were able to use equipment that we already had. And what it was the issue holding it back was an operational problem. It wasn't because of money. I guess people always say it's money, you know, they ran out of funding. But like this guy called me, it's called LVC. They tried to implement this program where we actually train with simulators, with live aircraft. But they can't get to it, right? It's difficult to get to the final solution. So they call me and they're like, well, what if I gave this random guy, what if I gave you $10 million? You know, like the government, I think he was just spitballing, but they had obviously $10 million to put around. And I was like, I can do nothing with it. You know, nothing. He's like, well, what do you need? I'm like, I need you just to use what we have, you know, just use it. I don't know. I heard that it's still going on, but anyway, long discussion on that. Sorry.
No, that's fine. And like, you've just retired in 2020, haven't you? So that's spanning what, 15, 20 years career there. You've talked about
20 years. Yeah. The final one was the tactical leadership program in NATO. And that was really the capstone. So enjoyable. You know, all the fighters come from around NATO, the countries that are involved, you know, UK, we got less fighters, you know, as your money dwindled. But working with all the nations as well, right? So they come together as a team with their planes and their maintainers for 3 weeks. And then they fly with the same people every day in this this course that we built. And it's an excellent program. It was amazing. So that was really the capstone. And that's what got us back to Europe. So we were living in Spain on the last assignment and just love Europe. Love how laid back it is. I think it's really focused more on a level playing field. You know, there is really high taxes, but you know, also the poor people there's much less as well. You know, I think it just cuts off the top and the bottom, you know, of society. So we looked around and we really like, Portugal. We were either going to live in Spain or Portugal, and then just decided on Portugal. People are so friendly and they're welcoming to outsiders.
Yeah, no, that's awesome.
Amazing surfing.
That time frame you're talking about, we know now that obviously in 2004 there was the incident with the Princeton and Nimitz, and 2015, 2019, and there's been all these other incidents. Was there ever anything you heard of in your time in that 20 years? And it might just be a no, to do with UFOs, no. UAP. It just was it ever talked about in the military from a European point of view?
No,
nothing.
We just never talked about it. I mean. Yeah.
That's fine. And I wonder that because that's interesting that so these things are happening, these events, these incidents, and these pilots are going up, David Fravor seeing what he's seeing, and Alex Dietrich and all of these other people, Ryan Graves, and it just goes it doesn't really travel that where you think it's quite an interesting conversation, but it stays pretty isolated. Which is pretty cool to know. At what point during this time was there still no interest in UFOs from you? And did that sort of happen afterwards?
Yeah, so I guess I didn't finish earlier, but so I've focused on physics and chemistry. And really the main argument is the universe is just so large, right? And we cannot travel faster than light. Nothing can travel faster than light. So even if there is alien life out there, as soon as it even heard about it or got any signals from us, electromagnetic signals, by the time they actually got here, it would be hundreds of thousands or millions of years in the future, right? That was basically the assumption I had. And, you know, all the physicists that I read, you know, I read like Stephen Hawking, I read several of his works on black holes. I read all of the major physics or physicists, you know, the mainstream physics, you know, even like Carl Sagan wasn't, you know, he didn't think there was any alien life, at least not on Earth. So I assumed that was it. You know, these are the smartest people we have, according to my thoughts. And this is their wheelhouse and they obviously have studied this their whole lives. So I'm guessing they're correct.
And that's a fair assumption. And I think that's why we still call it stigma, but the general public look at so many people like Neil deGrasse Tyson, Professor Brian Cox, name any other sort of, you know, high profile scientist, Bill Nye, the science guy, they generally talk down, ridicule, or don't go into the discussion on alien life. And the general consensus from these people tends to be, no matter what sort of show they're on, is there probably is alien life, but it's never been here. We haven't found it. It's not visiting us. It's way, way off in the cosmos somewhere. And for most people, that's enough. But then there's people like us who now have these podcasts and always want to know more. And obviously, we're going to get to the point where your most recent YouTube video was a really interesting 37-minute, you know, monologue almost, which is obviously came full circle from where you were previously. So let's talk about the YouTube channel and how that got started.
Yes. So I started creating, like I said in that last video, you know, I don't know why I started creating until just maybe this year. You know, a guy here asked, because I retired and I'm hanging out with, like, there's an awesome expat community here, you know, so I immediately made all these awesome friends. And one of the guys asked me, you know, he's also retired, why? You know, why the YouTube channel, or why the books? You know, because at that time I was writing a book, actually about the time I was in Iraq. I wrote that the first 6 months I retired. But he's like, why? And I went to give an answer, you know, to like reach for this answer and give it to him. And I was like, there's not a good answer. Like, I don't know actually why. And so, well, I love to surf, you know? So I was like, just for like a month, you know, I'm like sitting out there waiting for a board, you know, I try and surf a couple times a week just for fitness, you know? And I just remember sitting out there and just like staring, like, why do I do this? You know, it's like hours a day, you know, just sitting there, especially writing a book, man, just so painful. It's like 2 hours a day, you know, just only you, there's no one to bounce any ideas off or anything. But I just did it every day. I don't know. I guess I learned that from Brandon Carter, you know, that guy I mentioned.
Yeah. And can I just ask, Chris, the books, yeah, because people might be looking going, oh, Chris Leto's written UFO books. They're not, it's fitness, yeah, and crypto.
Yeah. Originally I wanted to write the video that I released last video. That's what I wanted to write somehow. I didn't have the full idea in my brain. But I was like, maybe I'll start writing science fiction, you know, I'll write like a science fiction. And then I'll somehow explain that the worlds are interrelated or they can like jump through dimensions or something. And then I tried writing science fiction. I was like, I cannot do this. You know, I couldn't even actually try. That's the problem. You know, once you can start writing something, maybe it would work. It's all practice and editing. And so the only thing I could write is, stay on target. And that's really, I watched Brandon Carter, and all of his things were just do it every day, right? The neuron passageway, the reason why you get addicted to things is, you know, once you get that thought, it goes through your neural passageway, right? The first time. But when you have it again, it actually thickens the neurons. You know, this is according to a video I remember back in 2014 from Brandon Carter. It actually thickens the neurons. So each time you think that or do that action, it's easier, right? That's why it's so easy to like brush your teeth, right? Or people that work out all the time, it's so much easier, just because that neural pathway, you know, is being thickened. So that was really his, and I am proud of the science actually. And there is some cool science I like in Stay on Target. It's just, there's so much in that book. It's just so many theories packed in. And ultimately I made it as a fitness book because that's what I was doing at the time. And that's what I could focus on. So it's called Stay on Target, Use Fighter Pilot Techniques to Get and Stay in Shape, from 2015. And then in 2017, I wrote Military Millionaire. And really the reason for that was to help or try and show these young like airmen, like you can be rich, like you can do it. Like you can become financially independent, but you have to change your behavior that you're doing right now. You know, like you have to focus on these things, saving, learning about interest, learning how to buy a home, you know. So I felt that was the easiest thing I could say that I felt had the most visible proof, you know, from my own life. You know, I was able to, I stayed on target, you know, if you will, and really worked out a certain way, kind of using a scientific method, and it worked. And then I did military finance, you know, I did financial planning, if you will. I learned from the Air Force Academy instructors. And it worked, you know, I was able to retire, at 43. So I wrote those books, but ultimately it's about this last video is why I started writing. This next book is it's a hard book. It was about my memoirs in Iraq. So basically 5 months, called The Ghost of Mordor Ali. And I still don't even know if this guy was like real. But he was basically this supposed Iraqi general. He was an artillery general for Saddam. This is the rumor. And then after the war, he still made it. And now he was traveling around Iraq, increasing the mortar strike accuracy at certain bases. This was this guy, Mordor Ali, right? Intel said he existed. And so he also, the guy, lived right off base, like literally like across the fence from from us, you know, and they would search his house and probably just harass this guy. But they can never find him, like in the act, you know, of mortaring the base or whatever. So it's kind of my interactions with this guy. We got some mortar shot at us, and then blowing up a truck. So those are the three books. I'll release Ghost of Mordor Ali when I can get around to maybe. I need to do a final edit. And the longer you wait between your final manuscript and then when you actually go to do your book, supposedly it's better. So it's just a perfect excuse to procrastinate.
I still find it really interesting that, I mean, you know, we're talking about all this stuff and it's bringing us right up to now, and only recently still you've really got into the UFO subject.
It was in
and
May.
This is where you've this is where you've taken off though, isn't it? Like, and it must be, is it surprising that this has just kind of blown up the way it has?
Undoubtedly. Yeah, without a doubt. You know, because I had my plan, you know, so to actually get into finally the YouTubing is, you know, obviously I have three kids and they love YouTube, you know, and we play video games and we watch people play video games, et cetera, you know, and they've said, I want to be YouTubers when I grow up. You know, I asked them, what do you want to be? One of them said astronaut. I was like, sweet, you know, but then all of them said YouTuber, you know, and as soon as one says YouTuber, they're all like, yeah, YouTuber. And so I was like, I can do that, you know, all you need is just start publishing videos, right? And so that kind of took off. And actually, it only took off because they talk so much trash. You know, I have my kids were just like, Dad, where's the YouTube channel? You know, and now every time I walk in and they're watching YouTube, they're like, what about you, Dad? You said you were going to start a YouTube channel. So finally, I just started making videos once a week. You know, that was it. Like, I made a pact with myself. I'm going to release a video once a week. And it was on anything I was interested in, which was awesome, you know? No one watched the video, or very few, right? 100, maybe a couple hundred views at the most. But I was really into crypto and new technology. You know, I love Elon Musk. I love Tesla. I love all the amazing things they've been able to do. And they're focused on sustainability and renewability, you know, basically renaturing the world if we can. So I started focused on that. And then I got into crypto and non-fungible tokens, which was, I think, is just amazing technology. It's going to change the world for sure. Yeah. But again, that was only 100. I had so you need 1,000 subscribers to get monetized, right?
Yeah.
And so after 7 months, I was at 643, you know, I was like, okay, you know, I'll get there after I make 55 videos. You know, I was hoping for 35. That was like in Think Media, you know, they're like, make 35 videos and you make it. It'll make it above 1,000, you know, and I was at like 30, I was at 34, actually. I think the 35th video was the one that actually, you know, whatever, went viral, if you will.
And was that the Mick West video where you were talking about his, well, I'll let you talk about how you came across the Mick West stuff and why you felt so passionately about it that you wanted to kind of come back on that.
Well, yeah. Well, it did start the channel, to be honest, because I made a video before that on the three videos, you know, where I couldn't believe it. And that's where really I just couldn't deny it anymore. You know, I saw the videos in the end of last year in November, I think is when I came up and I was like, I saw the Lex Fridman and then Fravor interview, the Lex Fridman Fravor interview.
Yeah.
And I listened to it straight through, you know, until like 2 a.m. And then I just like sat there, you know, with my eyes open and I told everybody, you know, my parents, I'm like, there's aliens, you know, and they were like, you know, they just look at you like you're crazy. And so I was like, maybe there's not aliens, you know, or my wife's like, yeah, I knew, of course, you know, it didn't faze her at all. But then I didn't really believe it. You know, I was like, oh, I'll ignore it. I didn't think about making YouTube videos about it or anything. You know, life just kind of went on. I did walk around kind of looking around up weirdly, but it wasn't until the 60 Minutes came out, you know, and I guess maybe that's just, you need something like that, like some mainstream event. So 60 Minutes is on there. I see Fravor again talking, and now Dietrich is there, you know, so there's somebody else. And I was like, okay, it's got to be legit. And then that's the first really I'd ever seen Lou Elizondo. I just hadn't heard of him, you know. And that's when I saw his statement on what ATIP, you know, what they were seeing, what all these craft could do. And yeah, so that from there, I made the video about those three UAP videos. But then a few people saw it as well, but I met a buddy here, this guy Barry. He's from the UK. Great dude. And he's like, oh yeah, hey man, I've been checking that out. You know, this guy said it's not true. You know, it's just a goose or something. I was like, what? And he's like, yeah, it's a goose. This dude says it, you know? So he pointed it out and I was like, a goose? Like, how is that a goose? You know? And I was like, okay, it can't be a goose, you know? And then I go and I started watching videos, you know, and just spiraled up. And then I made the video and that pretty much, that hit for whatever reason. I know there's a lot of frustration in just the community about Mick West. And so the people shared it, you know?
Now, you've talked about your background and your experience through school and college and the training that's gone into it. How many, what sort of hours or what numbers can you put on how much training you do to get to a level where you know what you're talking about? And you probably know where I'm going with this.
I guess know what I talk, what you're talking about. It's funny because I was a safety officer, you know, and there's basically like you can see where the most accidents happen in a pilot's career. And it's basically like, it's at 100 hours because they really just don't know anything, you know, so they're just dangerous, you know, because they physically don't know what they need to know. But then it goes back down, right? The accidents and then they're better, quite good until they get to 1,000 hours and then the rate climbs back up. Right. And then it goes back down at 1,000 hours. 1,000 hours is maybe like, you know, it depends 7 to 10 years of flying. So at that point, they start thinking they know what they know, what they think they know everything.
Yeah, they're getting cocky. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah, and you can see it. You know, you need people to lead, right? We need people to lead, you know, eight aircraft around, tell them where to go. It's all like these plays. You know, you're basically making intricate tactical plays, if you can imagine. It's more like American football. You know, you have a play and everyone's going to execute it, and then you have these audibles. So you do need someone to lead, but the problem is then they start thinking they know everything. So you do get a spike again in accidents. And then once they realize, oh shit, you know, they have some scare or something happens, they realize they're not, you know, that they are fatal or, you know, not mortal. And then it goes back down, right? So after that, after 1,000 hours. So probably after 1,000 hours, they really know what they're talking about, is what I would say. Once they get to that second scare, once they're like, oh, they don't die, you know, and then they make it through. It's like a filter, and then they get to after that.
So that's quite a long time, and you've got people out there. It's well documented. Mick worked on Tony Hawk's video game. That was his background. And listen, let's even talk about people like myself, who clearly has an interest in UFOs. I want every video or picture I see to be of some sort of exotic spacecraft, not from here or from here, but not human. And it's just not the case. I like to pride myself on at least being able to look at something and go, that's a balloon, that's something else. But I still don't tend to know what I'm looking at. So just yesterday, I retweet a video. And it was very quickly a few people got in touch and said, actually, it's a drone. But it did look, just to me in a very untrained eye, it doesn't look CGI. It looks like something's there. It's pretty low down. It's a big circle. So, yeah, someone tell me why this is fake. And I ask experts to kind of come back on this kind of stuff. And it's amazing the community does get in touch really quickly and is great to kind of, here's why it's this, here's why it's not this. Then you get experts like yourself who can tell you to a very, very good degree of accuracy. Like I watched on your recent video where you can tell just by the angle of something, if you've got 2 points, you can tell the height, the distance, all that kind of stuff. And then you've got complete amateurs like myself or others online trying to tell, no, this is why this is a spaceship from this planet, or here's why it's traveling at this speed, or here's why it's just a camera artifact. Does that frustrate you?
I was just going to say that as much as we loved Tony Hawk's growing up, there were plenty of bugs in the physics that I exploited for big multipliers. So, you know, the physics aren't perfect in that game.
That's a good one.
I did actually enjoy that game as well, yeah. And I used to like being able to defy gravity and go up. The Area 51 level was really good as well.
I always played 720. Did you guys have that game at your local Dairy Queen? I'm probably older, I guess.
There's no Dairy Queens in the UK.
Yeah, there's an equivalent or something.
I want them though. They sound fun.
Yeah, I don't. I think that's the problem, right? That everything comes down to evidence. I mean, every debate I've had with Mick West, even if I show it's completely bogus, all of his points, you know, we still have to say at the end, we need more evidence because you can't do much with one video. And at the end of the day, you know, it could be ultimately fake. Like, you know, it could. I don't think it is. Like, I think it's legit, but it could be. And so I'm trying to come up with a plan, a few plans actually, to get more evidence. I think the first thing is we can just start doing a better job of recording them. You know, if we can, I had a subscriber, this guy, Nigel, you know, he wrote on one of the comments and he's like, hey, I videoed a UFO, you know, what should I do with it? You know? And I was like, we'll put the video on YouTube. Maybe just give like, you know, date it happened, where, if you can. I don't even know if I said that. So anyway, he made this awesome video where it's him capturing this UFO and in UK. And then he, you know, films the clock and then tries to give a rough location of it. But like for these UFOs that are stopping, you know, you hear a lot of them are just sitting there, not doing anything. If it's just sitting there for like 5 minutes, like with Dave Falch, and we got a couple people, gee, all you need is two different people, like you were kind of talking about. Now we can triangulate it. And then if we can get, you know, more of them, all you really need is two, but the more you get, the better ultimately. So now we could actually get some real data, like actually scientific data, instead of just, you know, I saw a video on there and it looked like a drone and then people go and say it's not. You know, we could say, okay, Nigel released this video on last Saturday at this time over London. You know, did anyone else see something that looks like this and video it? And then now you just, it actually really is to upload, easy to upload on YouTube. So you just upload it on YouTube. And then if you, you know, it's very easy to access it for all of us. You know, I can just go to YouTube and copy it or video it, and then we can analyze it, et cetera. So just getting evidence right there is one way to do it. Plus it's fun, right? I'm going to have Nigel, hopefully I'll talk him into having him on the Disclosure. So Disclosure with Vinny Adams on Saturday.
Yeah.
I want to get Nigel on there. He's kind of nervous, but I'm like, come on, man. Like, explain it. I think it's cool. So I think just get more people involved. So that would be one way. It's just build up the evidence we can get now. And I think that is the strength of YouTube. You know, it's been called Web 2.0. It's kind of how I've heard of YouTube. Web 1.0 is like the dial-up stuff you have. You're basically going through a service. You know, you're going through AOL, and now they're going to email stuff. So basically, we were just going there to get information, essentially, was Web 1.0. And now Web 2.0 is like the YouTube phenomena. So essentially, there's no one in between me and, you know, you. Okay, if you're a fan, there's no one in between me and you, really, essentially. You know, I write direct to you on YouTube. I post videos. There's nothing really stopping me from posting videos.
Yeah.
So I think that's what we're kind of doing, is building this large neural network now. And so I think people like Mick West and people even, you know, like amateur astronomers or whatever, if they can find a good point, like, you know, you need that red team, right? Like I mentioned before, like the better the red team is, the better the blue team. So, I mean, I would appreciate if the red team was a little better, you know, I guess, or took it serious, more serious about finding the actual truth. I'm not sure. Maybe that is the aim. I'm not sure, actually. You know, I've liked all my interactions personally with Mick West. Actually, he was professional. He set a very good stream. You know, personally, I have no issues. And that's, I'm going to treat that way with everybody. You know, whatever their background is or what other people think of them, I'm going to give them a chance. And then if they, you know, they screw me over or whatever, then I won't give them another chance. You know, I'm not going for revenge or anything. But,
and that's the way to do it, Chris. Like I've said on this podcast before, Mick's a really intelligent guy, and some of the work he'd done on various different other campaigns, shall we say, was really good and really interesting. And I completely understand that both himself and other debunkers, they can recreate certain scenarios pretty accurately, but that doesn't prove or disprove another piece of video. It just shows you that you can make something look like something else. It's almost like, look, I could create this as a hoax if I wanted. That's yes. Great. You're not showing me that what's on that Navy video isn't something a little bit more exotic than our best technology. But like you say, maybe it is something more explainable, but we just can't do that right now. And can I just add, Chris, you know, when you talk about those YouTube videos, I love people send me them all the time and they'll ask me, and I always send them on for other people to check out who are more analytical than myself. I see these videos and it's the ones where there's just something in the sky that you've got a camera phone and it's great, your camera phone's 8K, but it's still filming an object however far away it is. You've shot nothing of the ground, there's no point of context for it, and you've cut it off before it's left. It's just an object sitting in the sky or floating along. And the amount of times people put on a video and say, we saw this object, it sat there for this long, and then it shot off really quickly.
Yes.
But you've got a 3-minute video of what you're telling me is a 5 or 10 minute experience. So straight away, I'm sorry, but no matter how good that 3 minutes of that object sitting is, I just totally disregard it, because you're never going to, or you shouldn't really ever be able to film a UAP or UFO arriving, because they're just there or they come into view really quickly. It would have to be pure happenstance or circumstance. You're filming that point in the sky or the sea, you know, if they're under the water. But what you can do is film it leaving. And that for me is always a frustration, because especially in the fake videos, when the object moves, it tends to give away quite a lot of the ropey CGI if they are indeed false.
Is it possible to even prove something's not a deep fake? I mean, is it possible?
I think it goes towards what you were talking about with triangulation. You know, if you could almost put something orbiting the Earth that would give you that second point when you're on the ground with the camera, it would be awesome. But
feels like a lead-in, Dan.
Yeah, it is. I'm queuing you up. So take it away. Do you have any ideas there?
Okay, yes. So there's a few. So that is the... You bring up a good point, Andy. And what you're talking about is that operational... you need that operational effect as well. Because everybody wants just the iPhone that works, right? Of course, we all wanted the iPhone that just does everything and you push all the buttons. You know, you remember before... Whatever, when did it come out? 2004, I think. Look at that. Before the iPhone, everybody was trying to make an iPhone. You know, the Palm Pilot. They had all these other devices. I remember I bought some crappy one that didn't really work, right? And they're all waiting for this perfect device, the iPhone. And that's exactly what was happening in the Air Force, or all of the military, I think, is this live virtual training. My whole career, 20 years, they tried to implement it and they were not able to implement it after 20 years, right? 20 years. Like, what have you guys been doing? At least, I don't know. They didn't implement it at my level that I saw. And like I said, you could do it easily with the equipment we had. It took some serious effort by the Lockheed contractors. They did excellent work and I helped them and work with them. They were very dedicated, smart people, but still, we were able to do that at no additional cost. And that's really through that operational thing. So you can really improve a lot of things by just doing what you mentioned there, Andy, like showing the ground, right? So that you can see, like, I can get an estimate of how high up now. And so we can get an angle up, like you just mentioned. And if there's a landmark in the scene, that's even better. And then filming it for as long as possible, like you said, in a date stamp, man. Put like another cell phone in front, just to get the time exactly, you know, because we do need accurate time, and then that would help prove it better, you know. And so if you just had 30 people do that, you know, they can't deep fake all those and then link it to some, it would be almost harder to stop the deep fake than it is to, you know, to create the flying thing, essentially.
But just before you come back on Dan's point, the only thing for me to go the other way on that one is, if we are talking about something that's potentially non-human, it's really difficult to say what that would look like, given at the moment, as far as we know online, there is no 100% proven here is a non-human aircraft or spacecraft. We don't know that they wouldn't look a little bit fake or would move a little bit jittery, or, you know, with some of the poor CGI, there's every chance out there there's a really good 100% real video that we've all watched and totally dismissed as utter nonsense. It could be one of those ones where it's landed in the woods and three little beings walk up the ramp, and you look and go, they're just floating across the grass, that's terrible CGI, that's like PlayStation 1 graphics, and then it flies away And lo and behold, someone in the government sitting going, or Lou Elizondo himself could be sitting going, ah, oh, that's the one, that's the one that we should all be looking at. But we dismiss it because we still don't know what is right. And that's, I suppose, part of the fun, the frustration, the mystery, what we kind of like and hate about this subject all at once.
And that's really why you need multiple angles, though, right? Because,
yeah,
you know, it showed in my videos, if I know how big the object is, then I can tell how far away it is. But these things, we have no idea, right? We can't, you know, there's no database that I know of anyway. But if we get two angles now, we can approximate its location. And then now from there, we can determine its size. So that's really important. So I think the best would, just the same thing, look at YouTube. You know, it's a giant neural network. That's why we're able to amass information so fast. You know, more data has a quality of its own. What is that? Mass has a quality of its own. So if you get a certain amount of data, right? I mentioned before, if it's over 30 points, now we can use statistical analysis, you know, to determine, could it be fake? You know, with 30 plus points, given these information, you could actually say with like mathematical certainty, or not certainty, but close to mathematical certainty, that it would be impossible to fake this, you know, but that we need more data. So I would say first thing is that, like, the easy kill, right? is train people to do it better. And then it would be on implementing better systems. So I've been working with Martin in Denmark. He's for Danish UAPR. And he's basically putting together a system with FLIR and prototyping it. So the idea, there is a couple ideas, but the main idea is to fund whatever project we do with NFTs.
That is all for this week's show. Thank you very much for listening. Please remember to leave the podcast a review on your chosen platform. You can like, retweet and subscribe. That would all be very much appreciated. The shows are being uploaded onto YouTube as we speak more and more. You can sign up at patreon.com/thatufopodcast to access the shows ad-free as well. Please get in touch on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, thatufopodcast. Of course, on Twitter, it's @UFOUAPAM. And again, folks, as always, keep looking up. You never know what you might see.
It wasn't a Tic Tac and not quite a saucer. More like a hubcap designed by Chaucer. A little baroque and quite steampunk, like Alice was playing bass for the Parliament of Funk. The little fucker hovered right outside of my window, and when I shoved out the screen, he made it an issue. I don't think he expected me to see his ass, but I'd had some champagne and smoked a little rain. Meditated game of state full on meta. Can't imagine how it could have been any better. I got to the top of the stairs and there he was. Like, you awake? I was about to abduct you, cuz. I jumped back and nearly kissed myself. And I climbed out the window after the elf. And I woke up in my bed and there was something on my head. And everything was weird and everything was red. And I called up my boys. They thought this was noise. They thought it was a dream. They thought it was my toys. They thought it was my problems. And they think I should take care of me. And I don't know what to do because it doesn't really scare me. If you really want to know who I think they be, I guess you and me and us and we and him and her and that and she and that thing over there and what's that, Jake? Consider your heart, consider time, consider your space, consider your lies, consider your life, consider your eyes.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Kosai. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Kosai starting on May 10th. So get your tickets now at kosai.org.
Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.